the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fuck tuplets? If there are any out there, how are you? What's happening? Everybody okay? Are we good? I talked to David Hidalgo from Los Lobos. Yes. Now, the weird thing about me and Los Lobos is that, you know, like, look, with any band, I know the albums I know, and then I listen to a few new albums, but going back into the Los Lobos catalog, I start to realize, holy fuck, this is probably one of the best bands that ever lived. This band makes most other bands look like fucking novelty acts. These guys are hardcore pros, paying their dues on the wedding circuit and dance club, sort of a Latino dance club circuit, Mexican music, Mexican folk music, Mexican dance music, doing the weddings. That was like their Hamburg for the Beatles, was the, you know, playing these events. And man, there is no band that's tighter and looser simultaneously than Los Lobos. No band understands each other in such a fluid and connected way, can create so much space, such a beautiful goddamn sound of true American music. I guess people compare them to The Band, because The Band was one of the first kind of consciously in a way, or I guess it was kind of hung on them, this idea of American music, Americana music, of an indigenous music to America that kind of was rooted in Appalachian music, country, some jazz and some funk. But, you know, those guys were Canadian, not to judge. And the one thing they were lacking was the Latino foundation, the Mexican roots. And that's where the true American music of Los Lobos comes. And you can hear them. You know them immediately. It's astounding to me that people don't really dig in to the entire Los Lobos catalog. But this new album called Native Sons comes out next month, but I got to listen to it. It's all kind of LA related or based covers of music that influenced them when they were coming up. And I talked to David about it because I was pretty fucking excited about it. You'll hear that momentarily. We also have a new segment on the show that we're starting today. It's called Get to Know Tom with Tom Sharpling. You'll hear that shortly as well. I would also like to throw a little love to the Sparks Brothers documentary. It opens in theaters tomorrow, Friday, June 18th. Edgar Wright put this together. It's his film. The Sparks Brothers. I don't know if you know Sparks the band. I've tried to lock into Sparks the band. I can't say that I have yet. I did enjoy the documentary. I learned a lot. It was impressive, but I still have not quite locked into that band. And they've done like 1,000 records, and there's many different sounds, but it's seemingly that, and I respect them, but I don't listen to them. I don't know this if this is necessary for the plug, because the movie stands on its own. And it's not a paid plug. It's, you know, Edgar asked me to watch it. I watched it. I was like, holy shit, I didn't know any of this. I have a few other records. I'll listen to them again. I now have a new respect for them, but that was the last time I listened to them. Not that you're going to listen to Sparks every day. Enough. Enough. Okay? Enough. You know, sometimes we haven't done this in a long time, but, you know, we used to do short interview segments with people who, you know, friends of the show or whatnot. But this is something different. This is a new segment on the show for a limited time only. It's a limited series of segments called Get to Know Tom. Some of you know Tom. Tom Sharpling's a dear friend of mine. He's been on the show many times. He appeared at the beginning of one of my HBO specials, Thinky Pain. We've done several Mark and Tom shows together that you can also listen to. So to some of you, he's not a stranger. But the point of this is he's got this book coming out. What's it called?
It Never Ends.
Yeah, the book. It's a book about Tom. It's a memoir called It Never Ends. And I read it. And it's, you know, it's a difficult position to be put in. I have to be honest with you, Tom. Hey,
okay.
Well, you never know, man. You know, some a friend of yours is like, "Will you do me a favor? You know, will you read my book?"
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, "What's?"
I've been in both sides of that now. For the first time in my life, I'm on the other side of that.
Where I'm like, what does he want? What do I have to... I can just blurb it without reading it. Yeah. Is it a blurb? Yeah. Or is it? Does he want notes? What am I supposed to do? And but I read it, and I've done that twice. It's only happened to me a couple of times, actually. And I think maybe it's people have sent me books before, and I haven't read them. But mm-hmm. I read the whole book, and I don't know you that long, or you know, turns out not that well, even. I didn't know any of that stuff, but why would I? It's not like when we talk, we're professional broadcasters.
Yeah.
Generally, we're friends. We eat dinner and stuff, but I'm not going to be like, you know, Jesus, what happened?
Yeah, you don't just go like, so tell us, 10 years old, what was that all about?
What happened to you? Like, why? Why you like you are, you know what? But the point is, I guess there's many points, but it's a great book. And I think we should just sort of, let's just so people know, like, you know, what do you do? I know you host The Best Show.
I host the show, The Best Show.
Yeah.
Which I've been doing that for, 20 years.
20
now.
Years.
20 years doing this.
And it started on terrestrial radio.
Started on a station WFMU.
Right.
And that was standard old-fashioned radio.
Right.
And then...
But like in the, you know, in the book you talk about, you know, how you were very excited to get the job.
My God, I couldn't believe it. It was like, you just grow up, radio was my thing.
It was?
Like idolizing and fetishizing just disc jockeys. And when you get into like personalities.
Because you're like New Jersey guy.
Yeah, so I would hear all the New York, all the New York stations.
The early talk guys.
Early talk guys. Bob Grant.
No, I don't know that guy.
He was that's a right-wing piece of garbage on WABC, but he was... He's one of those guys where it's just like, you're really funny and great at this, but you're evil.
Yeah,
like you're using it for evil purposes.
Like so many of them.
So many, turns out.
Yeah, there used to be a guy, I had to do an evening show here that was preempted frequently by Clippers games. Like it was a live show at 10 at night because it was some sort of like a placeholder when after Air America fired me, they put me on the air. I can't remember the name of the fucking channel. But it was a night show. Brendan came out here to produce it, you know, for a while.
Okay.
But literally, if it was women's basketball season, they had a pre-existing contract with that to go live.
Yeah.
So we'd have to wait until the game was over to start our live show.
And we're in overtime.
Ziegler was the guy's name. And there exactly. There was a right-wing guy named Ziegler.
Okay.
You know, and he was sort of on the same floor, different channel, but like two studios down.
Yeah.
And the worst, most malignant fucking right-wing douchebag, you know, but he was good at being a broadcaster.
Absolutely. They are exclusive.
Yeah. And right. So I remember there's one time we're at the urinals and I'm like, you know, you're really, you're good on the mic, man. He's like, really? I mean, I didn't think you would think. I'm like, dude, I mean, you're like, yeah, all right, just take it.
You're a horrible human that happens to be good at broadcasting.
But you just knew it was going to be your thing, right? I mean, because I know you cover this in the book, and it's a great story, you know.
Early on, you never can dream it could even be your thing. You just love it.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's a million miles away.
Right.
Especially pre-podcasting.
Yeah. But did you ever imagine this? Did you ever think, well, I mean, it's different because, you know, you're a unique radio guy. But let's be honest, just as you were saying, and this is off topic.
Mm-hmm.
But Kevin Christie he framed it in a way that, like, I never really thought about it. Like that, you know, in light of the podcasting thing, it's like, who knew so many people wanted to be mediocre radio personalities?
Oh, my God. It's the craziest thing. When suddenly, who knew everybody just wanted to shoot the shit?
But it's so terrible. There's some people that, like, are better at other things. Basically doing, you know, mediocre midday radio style.
Yeah.
And they're not good at it.
No. They have lowered themselves.
Right.
To a thing that I didn't even think they know what that was. They've gotten it through, like, it's like three steps down. They didn't listen to that and say, I want to be that. They want to be the person who is influenced by the person who is influenced by that.
And as a comic, you know, going into these places, you always know you're up against these guys, these regional guys, and you go in, and there's always a sidekick guy. He's like, I used to do stand-up. Mm-hmm. And you never wanted to be that guy. You know, that was like, that was if all things failed, you hope you could be the you know, the chuckle guy.
Yeah.
The guy, you know, chiming in on some local radio show.
Yeah, it's like in music, it's like the last refuge of the scoundrel in music is you go become a country artist. Because they'll apparently accept anyone that pretends that just like, I like country's my favorite thing. And they're just like, we like you then. But in comedy, it's that.
Yeah, it was just like, and now I just like, now I cannot get that framing out of my head. That like, you know, everyone now is just like, for some reason, they've just forgotten that radio was the end of the line.
Yeah, no,
not some practical way to try to get traction.
No, you, like Howard Stern used to say, it was the lowest rung on the showbiz ladder.
It, for sure it is.
And he was 100% right about that.
With the largest egos.
Yeah.
We used to go in, you do these morning shows, mm-hmm. and you're having a cockfight with, you know, like Joe Nobody.
Yeah.
You know, who's like, you know, he's got the drive time in the entire Columbus area. It's like, this fucking guy, and they're causing you trouble. They're like, we're going to fuck with the comic. I'm like, I'm just going to sell a ticket, dude. Yeah. And
then, but these guys are just meanwhile terrified that somebody's going to just walk in and go like, yeah, we're just changing the whole thing. Now we're playing, it's a Latin station now. Everybody out. Like, that's hanging over their head every day.
When Clear Channel was, that's not happening. It's like that Cleveland story. We must have talked about that. When I go to do morning radio, I get off the elevator and there's just some sort of commotion. Uh-huh. And some guy runs by, he's not wearing a shirt and he looks exasperated. I'm like, what's happening? And they're like, hey man, just be cool. The something went wrong with the puke cannon and we're going to have to move you into another studio. I'm like, what the fuck is happening?
I'm not sure if you should be happy or sad something was wrong with the
puke
cannon.
But that was just like the end of it.
Yeah.
I forget the guy's name. It was terrible. And it's like, yeah, man, we had some guy drink milk and then we altered a leaf blower. And I'm like, what are you doing? Yeah. It was like, this was like, to me, this was like the end of shock radio. Like the device that, you know, that they had gone out of their way to create, to manufacture, to reinvent some. It was ridiculous. The puke cannon, it just blew up. Just puked milk all over their studio for no reason.
And nobody can see it.
No one cares. Well, there's probably a video element, but it was just so stupid because there's always nine dudes involved, you know, like at those morning shows. Yeah, there's like that. Yeah, that's Billy will get it. You want something to eat? Billy, get him something to eat. Yeah. And that guy.
John Worster, who I do stuff on The Best Show with, we do comedy stuff, and you know John.
Yeah.
John, growing up in Philly, would listen to classic rock radio, and then one week there was a format change where the classic rock station tried to go like punk or like they were going alternative.
Yeah.
And there was this old guy who he would listen to on the station and then he's listening and now there's this guy on same voice, but now he's calling himself Mo Hawk. And then John called in. He's like, wait, hey, are you aren't you the guy who, like, you're not, you know, that's not your name? He's like, yeah, it's not me. They're making me call myself Mo Hawk. He's like, I'm out of here, but this is my last week.
Radio.
Mohawk. That an adult has to, at some point, say, like, I guess I'm calling myself Mohawk today.
But it is a specific talent, and not everyone can do it, and you're great at it. And it was something that evolved, like, the guys that are good do it like nobody else somehow. And you've kind of figured out your own niche with The Best Show, which is hilarious. But how did that evolve? It just sort of, you just started, I can't remember. I know it's in the book.
Yeah. It started off doing a music show.
Yeah, right, right.
Because I was on WFMU, primarily a music station.
In New Jersey.
Jersey City. Was in East Orange at that point.
Yeah.
But doing a music show, and then slowly the balance was like 99% music, 1% talk. And then it just kept going to where I was slowly talking more and more, and that just made sense, and I was like, oh my god, this is what I want to be doing, not just playing records.
Yeah, and you're really good at the music beds and the pausing,
all that. But the appeal was to use the music as a complement to the talking.
And
that just then it just was like all bets were off. I knew what I wanted to do with it.
But it's interesting because you come out of this, you know, this other part of your life where, you know, like there's like stuff in the book where I'm like, you know, like, don't you want, like, you know, what's that stuff about like your name, like, you know,
I mean, we've got to save something for the. There's stuff about my name and.
Yeah, all right.
It's in the book.
All right. Okay. Yeah, you know, all right. You're right. Yeah, we should even want more. Right?
Yes. So, no, people should if you want it.
It's crazy, man. That whole thing in the book is crazy. Do you want it?
No, please just, I mean.
All right. No.
Talk about some things, other things I'd prefer.
Do you want to get something to eat or?
Yeah.
All right. So we'll do it. Let's do it again. I'll try not to. We'll do this again.
Sure.
You know, a couple more times. I want people to. The name thing's good, though. It's all right. We'll do it again. We'll do another one.
Okay.
We'll save some of it. So look, folks, you can go order Tom's book. What is it called again?
It Never Ends.
I read a memoir
with nice memories.
I know what it's referring to.
Yes, you do, and also in the book.
All right. So I'll talk to you. We'll do it again. It's at tomwroteabook.com, and you can order it other places too, right? At book places.
Oh, any bookstore will take your order for this book.
All right, we're gonna do this again, and Tom will tell. I guess you're just gonna be selective about, you know.
We'll talk.
Oh, fine. All right. Okay, we will have another talk with Tom. Tom Sharpling, the amazing Tom Sharpling, next week, so you can get to know him a little better, and then get his book, It Never Ends, so you can get to know him a lot better, like a lot. Pre-order it at tomwroteabook.com. Okay, I'm very excited to have had this conversation. I have a tremendous amount of respect for the band Los Lobos. They are still out there working. I'm looking forward to going to see them. I believe me and Gimme Gimme Dan are going to go see them at the Pacific Amphitheater with X and the Blasters. I think it's like the first day of August, maybe. The new Los Lobos album is called Native Sons. It's a collection of songs by Los Angeles-based artists that were influential to the band. The Beach Boys, War, The Blasters, Jackson Browne, Buffalo Springfield, and more. It comes out on July 30th. I think I'm going to see him on the next day. Yeah. This is me and David Hidalgo. Well, yeah, I get weird about sound, so I'd like this room to be more than it is, but yeah, I got to put these panels up so the shit don't bounce around.
Right. Yeah.
you know? Man, I like it dead. I like that sound to just be dead.
Yeah.
What kind of guitar are you playing these days? What's your main one?
I usually go back to a Telecaster, you know.
Really?
Telecaster, Strat, and I was playing an SG for a while.
Really?
Yeah, I still... I go back and forth.
Well, the SG, that's different sound than those Fenders, man. Right?
Yeah.
It's a little thicker.
Yeah, it is thicker, but it's, I don't know, the neck pickup on an SG is just, it cuts through. You know,
I
played Les Pauls and I try to get, I love Les Pauls too.
Yeah, you know? Right.
And, but the SG just had the, it was there.
It cut through, huh?
Yeah.
I guess it's because it's just that, that humbucker sitting on, the body's so thin.
Yeah.
Right?
I think there's the whole makeup of the guitar with the neck, you know, way out here.
Yeah. And I have, that one, I got it, that black one, that Captain Kirk one, he sent that to me. I'm not even that great a guitar player, but I try to get as many guitars as possible for free.
Oh, yeah. You're one of us.
That's how it works, man.
Yeah, man.
I talked to Steve Miller, right,
mm-hmm.
About a month ago. Because he releases this movie of a concert he did in the 70s. And they're all playing these ridiculous guitars, Ibanez guitars.
Right.
And one of the guitar players had a Music Man. And I asked him, I said, what the fuck was with the Ibanez and the Music Man? He's like, Gibson and Fender wouldn't give us anything. So we took what we could. The Ibanez said they'll make us anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Iceman.
Yeah. Right. That's what the one with the big hook on it.
Yeah,
it was their version of an Explorer, kind of.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they were playing.
Yeah, I remember that.
Two of those. So, do you guys? Are y'all still living in L.A.?
I'm in Orange County now. I've been out there for 16 years.
Oh yeah. Is it nice out there?
It's nice. It's pretty sterile. It's okay. It's all right.
You sound like you didn't have a choice in the matter.
Well, I had a little more room out there.
Yeah.
A bigger yard.
Yeah, yeah.
I have grandkids now, so they need...
Oh, yeah. So you need to
run around.
Run around. Yeah. But you guys, you started here. You grew up here.
Yeah, I grew up in L.A. Yeah.
What part?
Well, East L.A. down by the Long Beach Freeway, by out that way.
Yeah? Yeah. And what was did you come from a musical family?
Sort of, yeah. Appreciation was high in the family.
With your how many people? How many people in the family?
We had three brothers.
Yeah,
three brothers, and my dad, you know, he liked to have a few drinks and liked to sing.
Oh yeah,
yeah. He liked the Ink Spots and Louis Prima. Louis Jordan and stuff like that. That was his.
So that's what you grew up listening to and hearing?
Yeah, I heard a lot of that.
What'd he do, your old man?
He was a truck driver.
Oh, yeah?
He delivered caskets for...
Caskets?
For West Coast Casket Company.
That's heavy.
Yeah. Yeah. They're empty, you know.
But... Yeah, no. But that's one of those things when you're a kid, that's kind of a heavy thing. It's like, what'd your dad do? He drops off coffins.
Yeah.
Delivers caskets.
Yeah. And we lived in the... He got a deal with the company.
Yeah.
So we lived in the office, and the warehouse was... that was our backyard. It was full of caskets.
So you guys could go play in the caskets?
Yeah, we play hide and seek in the caskets.
Make some vampire jokes?
Oh, yeah, all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad loved vampires.
Well, that's good. He was in the right business.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when did you start playing?
I was about 11, I guess.
And you started on guitar?
Yeah. Well, drums first. My brother was a drummer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he taught me just basic. Where to put it, you know, where to one, two,
yeah,
three,
yeah, yeah.
Four,
you know. Can you do it now?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't played in a while, but I enjoy playing drums.
Yeah? But you started with the guitar. When did you pick up the accordion?
That wasn't until later, the 80s. You know, the Lobos got into the Mexican folk music back in the 70s. And
how long you guys been a band, man?
Since 73.
It's crazy, dude.
I know.
Well, how old were you when you started?
I was 19.
And it's the same dudes?
Yeah, same four guys, yeah. I don't know how we did it.
And you all get along still?
For the most part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I listened to the new record. I'm a big fan, and I hadn't, like, there were some records I hadn't listened to in a while, but it's like, what's amazing about you guys is that, like, even with this new record, with the Native Sons, with all these covers, except for the one new song, I mean, even though they're covers and even though we know some of them, somehow or another, they all sound like you. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
that's good.
It's good. Yeah. You know, like that. And it's all through all the music. It doesn't matter what style of music you're playing, which is sort of an amazing thing. You know, it's a testament to how connected you all are. And that just comes from fucking being together since 1973. It's like, what is that, 50 years almost?
Just about. I think, yeah, probably this year or next, well, it's coming up.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah.
So, well, how does it start? So you're in high school or what?
Just out of high school.
And you're playing, at that point, you're just playing guitar.
Yeah.
And you meet where do you know the other guys from?
We all met in school.
Oh, yeah? In high school?
High school.
Yeah.
One of the friends, he's not in the band anymore, but he went off, he's like a year older than I am.
Yeah.
And he came back from... college break or something.
Yeah.
And he'd got into Mexican folk music.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know, come down and play, you know, we're doing this stuff. And I'd never, I mean, the music was around. I thought, you know,
not conjunto music, but Mexican folk music?
Yeah, more like the regional stuff central Mexico. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
A lot of strings and violins. And
no accordions.
No accordions.
Right.
So, you know, I always wanted to play mandolin, you know. Yeah. So that was a good excuse to learn because we couldn't play violin.
Right.
So we were trying to play the violin parts with the mandolins. And
you figured out mandolin on your own?
Yeah. We just kind of, you know, little by little.
Yeah.
You know, song by song.
So you worked out a Mexican folk set list?
Yeah, we had about five songs and we'd play.
You and that one guy?
No, it was Caesar was there. And
yeah.
Then I invited Louis down.
Yeah.
And then through Louis, Conrad came down. So before you know, we had five guys and five songs.
Playing Mexican folk music.
Yeah.
What'd you do with that?
Yeah, but we looked more like Canned Heat. You know, we all had long hair and beards. And
you like Canned Heat?
I like Canned Heat.
They were great, right?
Yeah, they were
great. That Wilson guy could sing and play that harp.
Yeah.
Did you do that record, man, with the guy from Canned Heat.
Oh, yeah.
Hound Dog?
Hound Dog, yeah.
Holy shit, that's a great record.
Thank you. Yeah.
Wait, you can't get it on iTunes, though.
Yeah, I don't know. Well,
I had to find the CD.
He owns the rights to it, so, I mean, and he passed away, and I don't know what his family's doing with it.
What's his name again?
His name was Mike Helby.
Was he with the Canned Heat from the beginning?
No, he was later.
Later, right?
Yeah.
Because like those guys at the beginning were, I didn't realize it, but they were all like, there's a couple of those bands back then, I think Butterfield too, that were just so, they were like blues nerds.
Yeah, yeah, they're record collectors.
Yeah, deep in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how'd you, when did you make that record?
That was in mid-90s or something,
yeah.
I think.
And what, how'd that come about? Because that thing was like, there's no record that sounds like that, man. It's kind of very deep groove.
Well, I met him through a friend that had a music store out in the Whittier area.
Yeah.
And we just started talking, and Mike had a studio at his house.
Yeah.
I guess the inspiration or the influence was Jimmy Reed.
Yeah.
And Donna Dewey.
Oh, yeah.
Those are like...
I don't know Donna Dewey.
Well, you should look into Donna Dewey. Sugarcane Harris.
Yeah, yeah.
He plays the electric violin.
Oh, wow, yeah.
He's the first guy to come up with electric violin.
Okay.
He took the stylus off of a record player and put it on the bridge of a violin and plugged
it
in.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah.
So that was the inspiration?
Yeah, because, you know, we wanted to do blues, but we didn't want a harp player.
Right. And you wanted to do it so simple but dirty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Jimmy Reed is like as deep as it gets.
He's great, man.
Oh, yeah. Great poet, too, man. Just the way he...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The things he said were beautiful.
Did you ever get to see him?
No, I never did.
Oh. So you guys are playing Mexican folk music.
Yeah.
And what did you realize, like, that there's not a big future in this, or what happened?
Well, we didn't know, you know.
What was the scene? What were you doing? You were playing parties, or...?
Well, it started off, you know, playing, they called them tamaladas, you know, where they'd little... tamale parties, you know, for like at the VFW and stuff like that.
In the neighborhood?
Yeah, around the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And we met, who became our manager for a little while. His name was Fernie Mosqueda.
Yeah.
He worked with the LA City Schools.
Yeah.
And he's the one that thought, hey, man, you could play, you know, assemblies, you could play colleges, you could do, you know, this is like educational type of stuff.
Yeah, because no one's doing this music. People should learn about it.
Yeah, so yeah. That was our way in. So that, he got us our first gig for the LA City Schools, and then we started playing at like East LA College, and we made a friend who was down there from UC Davis.
Yeah.
Recruiting students, and he heard us play, and he took us up to the Sacramento area. And that led to the Bay Area, and before you know it, we were playing all over California.
But this was this very specific type of music.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you got known for, you're almost like historians or playing some sort of folk music that people weren't familiar with. So the teachers were probably bringing students watch.
That happened, yeah. And we did that a lot. And then every Cinco de Mayo, we'd have like, you know, 30 gigs within 4 days and we took all the dash for cash.
So by that point, I'm assuming you had more than 5 songs.
Yeah, yeah.
It branched out?
Branched out a little bit, yeah.
So how long did you guys do that for? Did you think like, well, this is it? This is what we're doing?
Well, all that work
started
to dry up. When Reagan came in, a lot of the programs were
no
cut.
Kidding.
You know, a lot of the extra... You know, like these art programs,
oh,
arts
really?
Programs were cut. You know,
so you guys were brought in by teachers to inspire young people, in a way.
Yeah. While we're doing that, we were playing weddings and baptisms and stuff like that too. But
almost all exclusively Latino gatherings.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So Reagan comes in, shuts the school, you know, kills the spirit of the kids.
Yeah,
you guys get pushed out. So that's 80. What is that?
80, 81.
Yeah.
There.
And then what'd you guys...
We ended up... Because we had already had... we had started families by that time, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And...
Had to get money, make money.
Yeah, so we ended up playing in restaurants.
Like, you know, like mariachi style?
Yeah, like, you know, but we wouldn't stroll. We refused to stroll, you know?
That's where you drew the line?
Yeah, but every once in a while we did, but we would split up.
Play across the room with each other.
Yeah, one goes upstairs, the other guy goes the other way. You know?
Well, what was how did it work with like there was no drums, so what was Louis doing?
He was playing guitar. He's a guitar player.
Oh yeah,
originally, you know.
So who the like? I'm trying to think who the. It's you and Caesar who do the guitar playing. Mostly,
yeah. Well, all three of us play guitars now. Louis got off the drums. He'll play a couple of songs here and there but...
on drums, and then it's all three of you doing the guitars.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, man.
So we were in the playing restaurants, and then and that got boring, and we played this one place, And there was a drum set and electric guitar for the band that was coming on after us. So we started goofing off with it. And it led to rediscovering like Ritchie Valens and the music of the Midnighters, the East Side soul bands. So,
some of the foundation of this new record.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to remember the set list. I listened to it a couple of times, but I think I got the, I got it here. But you guys did, well, you did like an interesting bunch of songs, but you did some real old ones, huh?
Yeah, there's that Midnighter song on there. That,
yeah, I don't even know those guys. I should know. That's one of these things where I have a bunch of records and I grew up listening to my dad's music, but there's some people on here. I'm like, I don't know them. I don't know them.
Mm-hmm.
Like Farmer John, you did a lot, right?
Yeah, that's Don and Dewey, by the way.
Yeah. That's that's Don and Dewey. Okay. Yeah. And Sail on Sailor. So you guys started playing, you started playing the rock music.
Yeah, little by little, we worked our way, and that's when the accordion came in.
And how'd you figure out how to play that? Is it hard?
It's hard. I'm no good at it. I mean, no. I can play the songs I know. But that's
enough?
Enough to get by. But but we're listening to all this music, and Ry Cooter had done this record with Flaco Jimenez, you know.
You heard that record?
Heard that record, heard the way Flaco played, then I started looking for his records and, you know, just an amazing accordion player.
Right. Oh, that's so sassy. You picked it up.
Yeah, and I tried to, he was my inspiration, you know. And then a friend of mine, he had an accordion that he bought.
Yeah.
And it was just sitting in his closet, so he loaned it to me, and I just started
figuring it out.
Yeah, song by song again, you know.
Well, it's a vibe, right? It's a feeling.
Yeah, it's a good thing. It's beautiful.
So then you make the shift into sort of like old style rock music and conjunto music.
Yeah.
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 And all you guys could sing in Spanish, so it worked out.
Yeah. There we go. That was important.
Yeah. So what was the shift? So then you shift from restaurants to bigger weddings.
Yeah.
Now you've got drums, people can dance.
We could play the reception and the dance, you know.
but you must have done that for a long time.
We did it for a few years, and then at that time was when like the roots rock thing started happening, came out of the punk rock movement, you know.
Sure, but
I have to assume, Blasters and people like that.
Yeah, but like I have to assume that time you guys spent together, because you're still together now, but that time was almost like the Beatles in Hamburg, where you're just knocking out these gigs. You're probably doing like four or five a weekend, right?
Yeah,
years, and you're practicing. And it's like that's where all the dues were paid, so you guys were become like one mind, you know, in terms of how you play with each other, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much how it was.
So when the roots rock hit, well, that was a weird time, right? Because there was there's all these different types of bands playing simultaneously, right? Because like I've talked to Dave Alvin, I've talked to John Doe, I've talked to Rollins, I've talked to a lot of cats who were around then.
Yeah,
but there was definitely like a roots rock thing, but then there was like Insanity, right?
Yeah.
And they were you were kind of on the same gig, and sometimes there would be a crossover, right?
Yeah, it would be, you know, the Circle Jerks and you know, Blasters, and we'd play, or it was just all over the place. Or Joe Liggins, you know, from the Honey Drippers, the old kind of like Louis Jordan era musicians that lived here in L.A. So they would play gigs and
really,
yeah,
on the same night.
Same night, you know.
And so, like, what was the vibe then? So you're coming out of playing these weddings. So how do you transition? Who pulls you into that? Like, how does that happen? How do you start doing those gigs?
Well, it was, you know, I think just the idea of playing, you know, restaurants for the rest of our lives, like, scared us, you know. It was like, man, you know. And at that time, when the Blasters were doing their thing, and everybody, Sir Douglas Quintet had reformed.
Did you do a Sir Douglas Quintet song?
No, we didn't. We're doing all L.A. type stuff.
Oh, wait, you like that song, Mendocino?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. That's so
good. We got to be friends later on.
With Doug?
Got to know Doug, yeah.
Really? Did you play with him?
Yeah, he jammed with him. You know, he had the last Texas blues band for a while there? And he had this, you know, just a great, great band, you know?
Yeah,
and we were on the road and we'd run into him somewhere and we'd sit in and stuff that. We got to know him, and we did an album called The Super Seven.
Yeah.
And he was part of that too.
You know? Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Who was the original singer of the Sir Douglas Quintet? Do you remember that guy?
That was Doug.
It was Doug?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, he was the writer and the singer. And then Augie Myers was the the Triplets organ player, the Vox player. Man, it's a great band.
I don't know, for some reason I thought Doug was just a guitar player, but he sang. He did all the singing too.
Yeah.
So okay, so you didn't want to. You knew you're staring down the barrel at a lifelong restaurant gig, and you're like, "Fuck this."
Yeah. So then that's how we went to Conrad's garage, and we made it because we were playing Richie Valens stuff by that time, and a few maybe like Farmer John and a few like Conjunto music, you know, with the recording. So we made a cassette and took it to the country club in Reseda. The Blasters were playing, and met Phil in the in the parking lot. And passed the tape over to him, and a few weeks later, a few months later, Dave calls me and says, "You know, we're doing." They were kicking ass at that time, and they were like, they were doing five nights at the Whiskey.
Oh wow!
And so they asked us to open one of the nights.
Yeah,
and that was our big boost right there.
So that was it.
We owe those guys.
And I would assume if they were playing five nights, they had pretty solid following of those type of those kind of retro minded people. Must have been kind of a roots half rockabilly looking scene.
Punk rockers and rockabilly people.
Dressed up, greasing the hair up.
Yeah,
doing the thing.
Homeboys, everybody was there.
Wow. That must have been exciting.
It was cool.
What did you guys lay out? What do you remember the songs?
Like,
what was it? Were you do Richie Valens, or did you do?
We did. I think we did "Come On, Let's Go" and "Little Susie."
Yeah.
And then we did "Farmer John," and we did the polkas that we play. That we still play. Yeah. We used to do them faster because try to
punk it up a little.
Yeah.
The punk rock polka.
Yeah.
So, because I have that, they reissued that record, the Just Another Band from East L.A.,
mm-hmm.
the All Spanish record.
Right.
And I got it, I don't understand it, but I like it.
Yeah.
But that was a set list before you started integrating. That was your restaurant and set list?
Yep, that was it.
And you still play that stuff, right?
Yeah, we do. We'll do tours that we'll dedicate a tour to that type of music.
And so you're going out with X? Are you going
to? Yeah, we have a show with them coming up.
Yeah, are you guys friends?
They were good to us too. They would include us in some shows.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Well, they're sort of interesting because you and the Blasters are sort of dug into a root thing, and X is kind of like tilting towards some other they're leaning into some other area. That guy, I don't know why I thought to ask you. That guy, what's his name? Carlos Guitarlos?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yeah. He's out of his mind.
He's a Bay Area guy, right? Where is he?
No, he's from here. He's from Echo Park.
Because I was thinking about him, and I knew that David helped him out, because I bought that record that when he kind of came off the streets briefly and they made that record. Were you on that record?
Yeah, I think so.
You helped out with that?
Yeah.
But he didn't. He couldn't keep it together, I guess.
He goes in and out,
But, yeah.
But he's a great player, a great songwriter,
Was he back in the day, was he something to see kind of deal?
Yeah. They had a band, Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs.
Uh-huh.
And we used to play with it. They had that was one of the first gigs we got, too. They had it's called Blue Monday at Cafe de Grand.
Yeah.
And it was, almost like an open mic kind of deal
where
the bands could go up and play a few songs.
Yeah.
And so that helped us too. So we started getting in front of all these people and got to know Carlos and Gil T and Top Jimmy. And it was just, a drunken mess.
Right.
But it was fun.
Yeah. It's like a battle of the bands.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. It was cool. We got to know those guys. And
it must have been so wild. Because it was such a community, it seems like.
Exactly.
Everyone knew each other and everyone's just going crazy.
Yeah. Partying, everybody show up at each other's gigs.
And jam. And now you guys become sort of these elder statesmen, man. I mean, you guys are like the guys. You've played with everybody. You must have played with all your heroes by now.
A lot of them, yeah.
And you're a Peter Green fan?
Yes,
Because I got into him hard in the last 10 years. I can't believe that guy.
I grew up, he was a jammed with a friend of mine that played, he was a blues player.
Yeah.
And I found out that I didn't know anything about the blues. I knew Johnny Winter, which is cool, but it wasn't
the real deal.
And so then, Peter Green was the one that kind of put it together for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean.
That's interesting. So when was that? When you were like a kid?
Yeah, I was in high school. And Peter Green interviews with like Clapton, and you know they would talk about Otis Rush and Albert King, Freddie King.
Yeah.
So I started looking for the records. You know.
Right. Yeah. And, yeah. And you got hold of it. Got the hang.
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, you know, there's still more to learn.
I guess so. Yeah. I think there's more to. It seems like there's more to learn if you do less.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. That was the big. That was the lesson. You know, space.
Yeah, man.
You know.
Well, you guys certainly know how to take that space. It's kind of mind-blowing because you can go back and forth, but even in the stuff you guys play fast, there's such a unity of rhythm that I don't know what it is, but it's kind of amazing. I know people have compared you guys to the band before, but it seems like when I listen to you guys, like it's one of those things. Like I imagine Clapton's a huge fan. Have you met Clapton?
Yeah, we played the Crossroads festivals, yeah, yeah. You know.
He must love you. Does he?
I hope he does.
Yeah.
He did.
Did you play with him? Were you able to?
Yeah, he sat in with us a couple of times.
How was that? Was that
it was
mind-blowing or
yeah,
what?
Yeah. You know, when I was 14 and my, you know, playing the Cream records in my bedroom, you know, and there's Eric Clapton right here. It's like, yeah.
That must be great. He can still lay out the blues pretty good, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But you know, like I know he was a big freak for the band. Like there was this idea that when the band came on the scene, that like it was like, oh, it's over. These guys did it. They reinvented music. They've figured it out. But it, like, what's interesting about you guys, even from the beginning, in the way you kind of came up and together, not unlike those guys, but they were sort of Appalachia, and they're all Canadian, most of them, and they're coming up through country western. But you guys are doing a similar kind of roots thing in terms of uniquely American music, but you got all the Latino stuff in there. They don't have any of that. Like, you know, the band doesn't. So mm-hmm. You've got this whole other element, this whole other texture. I'm just blowing smoke up your ass now. But, okay. Yeah. But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, you can feel that because you can feel that element of where you guys come from in almost all the music, too.
Yeah. I you know, it was that homemade kind of approach, like the band, you know.
Yeah. Did you listen to them?
Yeah. We just did a lot. You know, they wanted a fiddle, they'd pick up a fiddle, you know,
right.
And, you know, and
yeah,
or mandolin. So we did that instead of trying to, you know, we did it in-house, I guess, you know.
Sure.
We wanted to hear, and through all the folk music, there's so many different, each region in Mexico has a different set of instruments. So
right.
All these different, so we had all that stuff, you know.
You figured it out?
Yeah. I mean, we're still working on it, but yeah, we had all that stuff to pull from, you know, or steal.
Right, yeah. And it still shows up in the music, like almost on every record. There's some of that in there.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So, it took a while to get to where we felt comfortable, where we could try to write a song in that style.
Uh huh.
Most of the time, it was just you know, we would play the old stuff and stay true to it. You know.
Where'd you first feel the confidence? What's the first song you think that you did that was, you know, kind of drawing from that directly? Was it on Kiko?
I was on the Neighborhood record.
Oh.
There was a song called Be Still.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's it was written in English, but it had that this 6/8 rhythm that's used in Mexico. A lot of music, you know, from Mexico. Huapango, it's uh-huh. called. You know?
Yeah.
And so we wrote took a stab at it, and it worked, you know, so it opened the door to more stuff like that.
To the confidence.
Yeah.
Necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just listened to that record, too. That's a great one. I didn't know Colossal Head that well, and I had to kind of get caught up on that. But how did the... obviously, the first record that I bought was How Will the Wolf Survive, but how did that... So that happened in that time, in the 80s,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It came out of the L.A. scene. How'd you get that deal? How'd that work?
Well, again, it was the Blasters. They were on Slash Records.
Yeah,
they told Bob Biggs, who's the main guy.
Yeah,
he's passed away recently, but said you better listen to these guys, man. Pick them up, you know, do something. So our first record was an EP because he didn't want to invest much into it. He wanted to make sure he didn't know where it was going to go. You know?
Right,
he didn't know how to sell it or anything. You know?
Right,
and
really, even with the Blasters, were the Blasters more defined to him?
I guess so.
Huh.
Yeah, he thought what do we go to the Latin market?
Yeah, right.
No, this is mainstream stuff, man. Just try it out there and see what happens.
Yeah,
you know? And it worked. You know.
Yeah. So he just put it out there, and the kids came.
Yeah, and then that led to Will the Wolf Survive?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it seems like on every record you do like at least a little one or two of each of what you do. Do you know what I mean? You mix it up.
Yeah.
You know, like there's definitely there's a rocker, old swing rock, you know, bop blues, jump blues, and then you got a Mexican song, and then you got like, you know, maybe a little countryish stuff, but you kind of mix it all up, right?
Yeah.
But and then like by the time you get to Kiko, then all of a sudden you did some other thing.
Yeah.
Like yeah. All of a sudden everything became wove together, and there was this natural sort of movement through everything. Did you feel that happening?
Well, you know, we did the Neighborhood record.
Yeah.
And we wanted to produce it ourselves, and the record company didn't believe in us, so they kind of just let it die almost.
What, the Neighborhood record?
Yeah.
It's a very thoughtful record. So it didn't get the push that you might have wanted. Yeah.
Yeah, so we were frustrated, and then Lenny Warnker, who was the head of Warner Bros. At the time, he always liked the band, you know, so... He put us together with Mitchell Froom. He says, "I think you guys would work well together."
Yeah,
and Mitchell was kind of in the same place with his career. He was like, "Man, he wanted to do something, you know."
Yeah,
something different.
A producer.
So, yeah,
yeah. Well, who else did he work with?
Crowded House. He did a lot of stuff, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah, and him and Chad Blake, who's the engineer, who was another. I think he's an alien, you know,
a wizard.
Yeah, he's just really amazing. So we all got together and had the same mindset. Let's do something that, you know,
no one's ever heard before.
Yeah, and we knew Louis and I. We knew it's a good opportunity to, you know, write some stuff that we haven't done before. Try to write better songs or different songs at least. You know?
Yeah,
and then that's it seemed to work out.
Well, so that's interesting. So that the guy who's as a producer. Was he brought a whole other point of view to it, right? Because he had his own way of thinking. If he did Crowded House and stuff, it's not, you know, he's not just like doing rock music. He's got a vision of some kind, right?
Yeah.
Got his own point of view, and the engineer's a wizard. And then so that kind of, you know, encouraged you guys to take it to some other level. Yeah. And what was the process of writing that? Because, I mean, it's pretty much universally seen as a masterpiece of a record. Did you feel like, how did you approach it differently on that record?
Well, like the first one was stuff that we played live. And then, Will the Wolf Survive, that's when we started, okay, we have to write some stuff.
You know?
We can't just play covers.
Right.
So that got the ball rolling. And then the difference was we didn't rehearse. We didn't go into, you know, pre-production or whatever, you know.
Right, because you weren't taking it on the road.
No.
So it was all studio work.
Yeah, so we'd come up with, Louis and I, or Caesar, you know, he'd come up with the songs and an idea, and we'd take it to the studio, and we'd throw it together there, you know.
Right, just build it.
Build it from the bottom.
And the guy used the studio like an instrument.
Yeah.
And so that was probably the difference. You guys weren't just working like grinding out songs as a band. You're kind of using the space differently.
Yeah, that's what we did.
Yeah.
And it worked. You know, and then having Mitchell's, you know, point of view, or listening, you know, he helped us refine a lot of the stuff. And then Chad just, you know,
we're recording
through, you know, exhaust manifolds and stuff.
Really?
You know, yeah, he had all these crazy ideas, you know.
To make weird sounds.
Yeah. Or tell him, you know, I'd say, man, this could use some backwards guitar on this song. So he flips the tape over and he goes, okay, go. I didn't know it was that easy. You know,
it's easy if you got a guy who knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Did you guys know Waits back in the day?
Around that time was when we met.
Around Kiko time?
Yeah.
Yeah? Is he a fan? He must be a fan.
Yeah. He's a good friend of ours, you know.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, he does kind of weird shit with exhaust manifolds and, you know, interesting sounds.
Yeah, I think it was Chad worked with him too. So
really?
Yeah, so they...
so that was the connecting tissue?
Yeah.
they got Waits doing the exhaust manifolds, and now as well, but everyone's doing the exhaust manifold.
Yeah.
And after that, what did you... Were you guys able to tour a lot of those songs? They seem tricky to play. And do you play... What do you play? There's a couple ones on there. What's on your set? Now, from Kiko.
We still do Kiko.
Yeah, yeah. Train. This train don't count.
Train, we do that. Yeah. Wicked Rain.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just a Man. We could do most of them. Not all of them, but we could do most of them, yeah.
How often do you tour? I mean, like before COVID. Were you guys going out?
Yeah, it was crazy. It was...
It seems like you never stopped playing.
We didn't. It was getting real tired, you know, like to the point where good to have the work, but it was around the time. I remember our last gig was March 9th.
3 days before the lockdown?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we were supposed to play, I think we were supposed to go to San Antonio or something.
Yeah.
And then our drummer at the time, his wife worked for the city of Pasadena. And she says, no, man, this thing is, they're not telling you everything in the news. This thing is serious, man. You guys shouldn't go anywhere. So we backed out of the gig, and then that's when the shutdown happened right
and
after
that.
And
it hit.
Yeah.
Did anyone get sick from the van?
No.
Oh, good. That's
thank
good.
God. You know, we've been all right.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
So, like, how did you feel about the break? I mean, even though it was forced, I mean, did you need it?
Yeah, yeah. Not necessarily that way, but
we
needed the break.
But you might not have taken it, hadn't
I? Yeah, you're right. It was great being home. It's great being home now, you know.
Because you got the kids, grandkids, everybody?
Yeah, yeah. I haven't been home this long since the 80s, you know.
Wow, man.
So it's a trip.
Well, you're lucky, man. I mean, like, the road's hard, and it sounds like you guys went at it pretty hard early on. I imagine you've all grown up out of that shit, right? You don't go too crazy.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not like it used to be. We're too old.
Too old,
we can't move anymore.
So did you guys do most of this record during the lockdown or no?
Yeah, we did.
So were you able to play with each other? Or were you sending stuff back and forth? Or did you guys just hang out?
Well, most of it, when we did it, we would, you know, we did the whole distancing thing, but we were in the same studio. We had masks.
Sure, well, we
test before we go in and make sure everybody's...
But do you guys, like, I mean, you hang out, you seem like, I'm always wrong about this, but I always assume that everybody hangs out, even though you've been playing together for 50 years. Do you guys, your families all hang out together and stuff?
Not so much anymore, but special events, you know?
Yeah.
But mostly, everybody goes to their corner.
Really? It's probably better, I guess.
Yeah, you know, we need a break from each other, too. But, you know, we're still friends. You know, we still get along good. You know?
So what was the conception? Before I talk about this, though, let's talk about this, the Disney stuff. Now, which one did you do? Because I know you did Los Lobos Goes Disney, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there was, you did, you were on a record first, right?
Right.
Did you do Walk Like Me, Talk Like
Me?
Yeah. Oh, I knew it. I don't know why, because I have a memory of that record, and that was just such a great song. And that led to the Disney record?
I guess so, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that seems like a fun thing to do.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was Louis Prima and Phil Harris did the original track. So we're Prima fans, so we're like, if we're going to do one, let's do that one, you know?
Yeah, it's great. It's okay. So in terms of conceiving this record, like, was this... Was it because you didn't have, like, new material, you didn't want to write new material, or did you just think, like, why don't we do our influences? Like, whose idea was that?
You know, I don't know whose idea it was. It was pitched to us to do a covers record.
Uh-huh.
And then we were, okay, that sounds cool. And then I don't know who came up with the idea to do it just of L.A.-based music, you know, artists.
Yeah, right.
And which, you know, narrowed it down, what made it, I think, made it easier to do. Well, after we found the songs, it took a long time to find. You know, we went through a lot of stuff.
Well, how many? And then you did one original one.
Yeah,
the Native Son record, the song, which is great. But these were like there are some interesting choices. You know, like Sail on Sailor, that was an interesting choice, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a Beach Boys
song.
Well,
you know, you think LA bands, you think Beach Boys.
But did you listen to them?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Listen to them a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they were.
that era of Beach Boys is good, huh?
Yeah.
I guess you listen to all. You got to listen to Surf and Safari.
You know, Good Vibrations and
that's good.
In My Room. And,
oh, yeah. Well, that's later. But even the early ones are great.
Yeah.
They did a cover of Barbara Ann that I used to listen to on that party album. What was it? Beach Boys Summer?
Yeah.
Remember that?
That's a cool record.
Yeah, yeah, man. And then you did the Jackson Browns. I just talked to Jackson Brown.
Yeah, that's another one. I mean, we just went through all the...
Jamaica Say You Will? Is that the name of that
Yeah,
tune?
That's the first song I ever heard from Jackson. And we just tried to touch on all the, like, War, another band that...
That was the other thing that amazed me, that War thing. Like, because I can hear War in your shit.
Well, we learned from them, you know. Yeah. They were, you know, they're from Central L.A., but they were big on the East Side. You know, they were honorary Chicanos, you know.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Because they always had that Latin element in their music.
That they were percussion. Yeah.
And through the years, we became friends with the guys, you know.
How many of them are still around?
Well, the bass player just passed away, but everybody else still.
Yeah?
Well, over the years, they lost the percussionist years ago, and the sax player died a long time ago, too. But
it's so funny that thing comes true because Lowrider was huge, right?
Yeah.
But once you guys played that tune, I'm like, all of it makes sense to me. Like, I think that's what kind of got me so excited to sort of talk to you and also just to hear the record. Because, like, you know, I've listened to your records, you know, half my life, you know, here and there. But then when I'm, like, someone said, well, listen to this, here's the new record. And then the idea of all this being your influence, it all made sense. Like, you know, I can hear all of this because you're playing them. I can hear you guys playing them, but I can also hear that stuff in your shit. You know, like, it all wove together. Like, these are very thoughtful choices.
We tried.
And for what it's worth, I mean, geez, man, I mean, that sort of seems relevant now, you know, that song. And that's a hard song because everybody knows that song, but you guys took it on.
It was hard.
Yeah.
We're afraid, you know, we're hoping that they would like it, you know.
Buffalo Springfield? What's left of them?
Yeah. Buffalo Springfield and the War and Sail on Sailor too, you know.
You were concerned that they would
approve, you know.
Well, how many of them are there to approve of it? I mean, like,
well, I heard that what Brian sent something on social media that he liked it, that he
oh,
heard
yeah.
it, and he liked it, and we played with Al Jardine this last weekend. He in Big Sur, he came up and played it with us.
He did,
yeah.
Oh, that's kind of beautiful, huh?
Stamp of approval.
That's for sure. If Brian says okay.
Yeah.
Well, have you heard from Stephen Stills? Who wrote that one? Yeah, Stephen Stills.
No, I haven't heard from him. We'll find out one day.
You ever played with that guy?
Yeah, we have.
He can play too, huh?
Yeah, he's a great player. I always liked his music, you know, Manassas. So do you ever hear that stuff?
His original band?
Yeah, he had a band after... Buffalo Springfield, and after the solo stuff and the
Manassas. Who's in it with him?
Chris Hillman.
Oh, really? I don't know if I know that stuff.
Yeah, you should check it out.
It's great.
It's big guitars. It's great.
Really?
Yeah.
Why you listen to that? What's that one? With Bloomfield, Al Kooper, Supergroup.
Super Session.
Super Session.
Yeah.
There's some good stuff on there, but a lot of those are separate songs by the guys.
Yeah.
Were you a Bloomfield guy?
Yeah.
I can't, Peter Green, I listen to it, and I'm like, I get it. You know, Bloomfield, I get it, but it's too much for me. It's a little mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Like, he just, like it's beyond my understanding, but it's great.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah. You know, have you tried to work out those licks?
I've tried, you know. Still trying.
Yeah. So, like, who are your main guys? Is it you went to the king, the three kings?
Yeah.
Who do you prefer out of those guys?
Oh, I can't.
You can't judge?
No,
you
can't judge. No, they're all.
Yeah. Did you ever play with BB or any of those cats?
But we've done shows with him, but never actually played with him.
Never sat in with him?
No.
Who were some of the guys that, you know, from, like, you know, your heroes outside of Clapton that you were able to play with? That blew your mind. Did you play with Stevie Ray?
Yeah, we did.
That must have been something to watch him play right up close.
Yeah, that was, first time we met him, we were in Lund, I think it was in Sweden.
Yeah.
And he was doing the big show at the college.
Yeah.
And we were playing a bar, you know, later in the evening.
Yeah.
So we went to his show, and then he came to ours and sat in with us, and that's how we met, you know.
Oh, you guys must have had a blast.
Yeah, it was fun. And, and then over the years, we'd run into each other here and there. We did some shows in Italy with the Pogues, Stevie Ray and ourselves.
It's interesting, like, lineups. And because you guys toured so much, you really, like, that was your whole life, is hanging out with these guys. All these different types of people. The Pogues, that's an interesting billing. It's you, Stevie Ray, and the Pogues?
Yeah, I think it was the accordion. Stevie Ray was the, you know, he was
the headliner.
The headliner.
Right.
And then the the accordion connection with the Pogues and Lobos. And that's, that kind of made sense.
It does make sense. It's a totally different approach, I guess, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's the plan now? How many dates are you going to do?
Well, as few as possible, you know. you know, I've gotten used to staying home, and I'd like to.
That's
like
a lot,
it.
Dude. I mean, yeah. You know.
Yeah, well, we did this weekend. We did four shows.
In Big Sur?
I did two in Big Sur, and then we played in Santa Cruz and up in Napa.
What were the venues?
The Big Sur was just a small outdoor amphitheater.
Uh-huh.
And Santa Cruz, it was at the Dream Inn. It's a hotel where we played poolside, and people, they rent.
Oh, I saw. I think I saw some footage of that. Yeah. They're up on the balconies and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It worked out all right?
Yeah. We did it earlier, you know, when the COVID was still, the lockdown was tighter, so that was the only way we could do a gig.
Uh-huh.
And we did some drive-in gigs, but it's little by little, it's opening up. And,
yeah.
But
oh, you did the drive-in gigs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a comic, and I just was like, I can't do it.
That's got to be hard.
I can't do it. And you stand there and wait for them to flash their lights?
You can't connect with anybody.
No, right? No, I couldn't do it, man. But I tell you, well, that's why I envy musicians. It's like, because of all these years you got, I mean, you know, playing those parties and playing those weddings and stuff, I mean, you can play anywhere. I mean, you know, and deal with it, right?
Yeah, and deal with it, yeah.
Some are better than others, huh?
Yeah.
How do you want to work in the future? If you don't want to tour, are you going to do more collaborations with people, or kind of lay low, or what?
Well, it's...
See how it comes?
Still, yeah, it's kind of up in the air still. Yeah. I mean, we will be doing more shows, but I hope, you know, we'll try to spread them out and not kill ourselves like we were.
Oh, it's sort of astounding how many things you were involved with. Do you look back on it and just go, holy shit?
Yeah, you know, I feel grateful. Been able to play with a lot of people that you know, we've admired over the years. And,
yeah.
Yeah. It's been good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wish you continued success, and I love the record, and it was great talking to you, man.
Well, thank you. Thank you, man.
Thanks for
having me.
There you go. The new album, Native Sons, will be available July 30th. When we were walking out, I asked him if he had any Strats, because I have a Strat, and we were talking guitars on the way to the car. I said, you got a Strat? You got an old Strat? He's like, I got one. I got a 58. I'm like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, Jerry Garcia gave it to me. I'm like, no shit. He says, yeah, we were playing with the Dead, and he said, you got a Strat? You want a 58 Stratocaster? And Hidalgo says, yeah, it's a little out of my range, man. He's like, no, I'm going to give it to you. And he gave it to him. He said he keeps it in the locker. So it's got Jerry Strat. There's a little trivia. Now I will play my Stratocaster. Not a 58. It's like an 87. Not impressive. Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.